This is us learning in public, trying to...
Literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We're at Vancouver Public Library. Yes. There are glass doors. Yes. We are literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
So nice to be sitting with you in the studio.
This teeny weeny studio.
Where it all began.
Basically.
The first one we ever recorded in.
The smallest room of all time.
Yes.
Contorting our bodies into this shit.
Closeness,
togetherness. From such a long time apart to so close now.
Exactly, I know. So this is the first time we're recording after taking our little hiatus. Cancel Culture is coming out first, but we had recorded that before.
Yes.
So this is the first actual recording.
Yes.
After the hiatus. And I'm so excited to be recording again, and I'm also less prepared for this episode than I would normally be.
Mm-hmm.
And the finished product after I edit will probably be less polished than usual. I usually don't just edit for content. I would meticulously go through and take out as many filler words and as many stumbles as I possibly could while still having it sound seamless so you couldn't tell.
You do a really good job of that to the point where sometimes I'll be like, oh, I could do the first crack of edits, and you're like, no, I'll do it. And I'm like, yo, bitch, you need to humble yourself. But the thing is, though, I never get to listen to the raw edit. I just trust you to do it. So then when I get it from you, when I get the track and I add music and do all that sort of shit, it's usually just like, oh, we sounded so amazing. Like my reaction is like, wow, we recorded that episode so flawlessly.
Yeah.
When in actuality, I could be like, Lala edited that shit so flawlessly.
Remember when I showed you all the cuts in that one episode?
It was disturbing.
Yeah.
And I just don't have the patience for that. So it makes sense that you are the one doing it.
And no one should. So this is the thing. I'm not even saying this as a disclaimer, although if I'm honest, it does make me feel a bit
better. You're like, I'm liberated.
Yeah. But I also wanted to say it because it's very much related to what we're talking about today, and that is what it's like to live with chronic health conditions.
Mm.
And, letting go of perfectionism and knowing limits and knowing when we have to just set things down, that's part of that experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
So the last time we were supposed to record, I ended up having to cancel on the day of because it was right at the worst of a health crisis for me. So I'd had vertigo intermittently for a couple months already, but then other systems of my body started crashing and it felt like everything was falling apart. And I was struggling to do anything, even eat, which is when it got to the crisis level, because eventually I couldn't even get out of bed because I had no fuel.
Energy,
yeah. And that's when I had to cancel recording. And it was really upsetting because I really wanted to get into the studio and cry about what it was like.
Yeah.
At that moment. We're going to do it now instead.
Yeah.
It might be a little bit less raw. I don't know. We'll see.
I know. I remember, it's been maybe a month and a half, a month. I don't know how long we've actually taken away from the podcast.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But since you told me about how you were feeling, the one thing that I was super aware of is, because I know how much this shit means to you and how much mm-hmm. you love recording and how much we both love being in the studio and creating, is I wonder how much pressure you were putting on yourself to try to get your shit together to, do it.
Yeah.
I imagine it was a lot because I know you as a person, you're a pretty tough person.
Yeah.
So I guess my curiosity is, when did you know in that moment I need to take a break and step back?
Yeah, it really was forced on me because even the first couple months when I had vertigo increasingly, I still was maintaining my pace.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be the end of the world if I had to cancel on a client and if I couldn't do the podcast, at the same pace, or I couldn't edit every filler word out the way I liked to or whatever. I thought it was all the end of the world. And it got to the point where I was just so unwell and suffering so much that I couldn't. I was like, okay, you know what? If I never can do the podcast again, and if I have to close my practice, and that is a thing that could happen and there's nothing I can do about it, I had to let go of control.
Ooh.
In that way,
Yeah, no, totally. It reminds me of stages of grief.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you've experienced that. I don't even know all the stages. I just know that people refer to it a lot when they're going through letting go of something. And it sounds like for you, you had to let go of this feeling in control, or that you can just power through things and really tune into what your body needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And there weren't always times where I knew what my body needed or could give my body what it needed. And sometimes it was about just accepting that I was in pain and suffering, and there was like nothing I could do about it, which was really scary. And that the stages feel very relevant, because there might be days where I was really angry about it, or I was really upset about it, or I thought, okay, well, if I do this and this and this, then I'll be able to do what I want to do. Bargaining.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, denial, I'm sure. When, remember the actual last time we recorded probably, and I was like in tears when you arrived, and was just like, oh my god, I feel like I'm gonna die, but like, we're still gonna record. And you're like, are you okay?
Yeah,
like, what
is happening? I've never seen you in that state.
So it was all of those things, and then feeling like I had to grapple with that I could lose everything, and that I was losing a lot. Like, a lot of the things that brought me daily joy a few months ago, I had to give up, like running, coffee, chocolate.
Wow. You had to stop eating chocolate?
Yeah, like just processed sugar. I can't really.
Right, of course.
Take.
That would make sense.
Sushi.
What? A bitch can't have sushi. Listen, every time I would hang out with Premila,
pretty much
time, we would always smoke a bowl and have sushi.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yes. And working became really, really difficult. And that was where I got a lot of my joy, was the podcast and seeing clients, which I've still been able to see clients, but I've had to reduce it a lot.
Right.
And it's, been quite a challenge.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So this is some of what I'm going through. And so I wanted to just talk a little bit about some of it, because it's also one of these topics where you and I, we have super different experiences of it.
Yeah, my proximity to this is so, at this point in time, it's so far removed from your experience.
Yeah, it's always interesting when we have such different experiences.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, a lot of things that we get to talk about together on the podcast, I think we share, maybe not share a lived experience, but we have a lot that we can say about it. And I feel as though in this conversation, I just want to listen to you and also ask questions, because I know one thing that I have been really cognizant about in this time, in your like this really dark season for you, is how I can be there for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if I'm doing it right, or like, so this is an audit. You can tell me how shitty I've been, but it's helpful, I think, because you're not the only friend of mine who suffers from chronic illness.
Yeah.
And I think it's always so difficult for people who are in the position of suffering and going through the shit to actually ask for what they need. It's hard for me to ask what I need when I'm not in the shits, you know?
Totally.
Even when things are all going peachy keen, it's tough for me. So I would like for you to take up as much space in the conversation and leave a little bit of room for me to ask maybe dumb questions, maybe not intelligent questions, maybe questions that I hope reflect the questions that other folks who don't have the experience of chronic illness or chronic pain, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was really hoping for from you, was just, I wanted to just see how things landed with you and what your honest first reactions were and like what questions you might have, because a lot of the stuff is so second nature to me. And so I'm really curious how it'll sound and how it'll land to somebody with such a different position. Because you had said, I think before, when we first talked about doing this episode back before we had to cancel, something that really blew my mind, which is, I think you said that you feel like at this point you've never had your physical or your mental health really hold you back from doing something you wanted to do. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that super blows my mind, because that's been like so much of my life is feeling held back by disability.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I still have a lot of privilege in that regard, right? Because I'm still, for example, I'm able to walk upstairs. I don't have a severe allergy to fragrances. Like, those are just a couple of examples of things that are huge barriers for a lot of folks to accessing physical spaces.
Absolutely.
And in terms of mental health, I haven't experienced psychosis. That's an example of a mental health thing that's still heavily, very heavily stigmatized, even Absolutely. As other yeah. mental health things become a little bit more understood. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of privilege, and then also disability is a big part of my life and has been for a long time. My health has made it so that I can't access full-time regular employment. That's part of the reason why I do what I do, is because it is more flexible and it is, I can set my own hours, and it isn't necessarily a 40-hour a week job. It doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's been a lot of pain and suffering and like a lot of loss as well. So yeah, I want to talk about what it's been like for me, and I know that I can only speak to my experience and not for a lot of other people who experience disability in different ways. Mm-hmm. But the first thing I really want to talk about is fear, because it shapes so much of what it's like for me sometimes to live with chronic health conditions. So part of it is my own fear. So it's like, am I going to be in this much pain forever?
Right.
Or what if it gets worse? Or what if this is a symptom of like a scary diagnosis that's looming? Mm-hmm. And the last one's been like super salient for me, because Western medicine's never really been able to
help you out in the way no. that it's supposed to help you out.
Yeah, no. Right. So there's like a lot of pain and suffering, and doctors are like, we have no idea. Who's to say? I don't know. Maybe you're making this up. Are you exaggerating? Like, the tests are fine, you know?
Right.
So without that like credible explanation or an effective treatment, the unknowns are like really scary.
Absolutely. I know. And I hope it's okay that I'm like, we're having this conversation. Like, you had an MRI recently, and I was like, oh, I hope you get to find out the results. And you're like, I don't want to find out any results. And I was like, oh, wow.
You're like, I hope it shows something. And I'm like, no, we don't hope that.
But even that, like, even that, honestly, it just goes to show me how far removed I am from even being in that wheelhouse. Because mm-hmm. the times that I have had to go to the doctor and had a test done, I'm like, I want to see what this is. I want to find out what it is, because mm-hmm. I want to have an aggressive treatment plan. I want to figure it out. And that's me as a person who's had one or two health scares in my life with air quotes around them. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I've had to go through on an ongoing basis where I'm always getting tested. I'm always, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just found that even my response, and then your back to me mm-hmm. to be really interesting. And when you just were talking about fear, I'm curious whether throughout any of this, because it sounds like it's been very hopeless for you. Mm. I don't know what the antidote to fear would be, but I would imagine having some semblance of hope throughout this would be such a salve to this situation, or at least be more comforting for you. Have you felt hopeless?
I have at times, definitely, especially when it was getting worse and I hadn't found anything that was helpful. That was really scary. And yeah, there were times where I felt hopeless. I don't think that hope is necessarily always the
big thing.
The antidote.
Yeah, yeah.
Which hilariously, like something I actually was going to share, a tweet I was going to share by @unicornthorn. It goes, me, I have a chronic illness. Chronic as in permanent, as in I'll have it for the rest of my life. The rest of my life meaning, yes, the rest of my whole entire life. Biotypical people. Hope you get better soon. Me, thanks, I won't.
Shit. Fucking shit, man.
So yeah. there are times where hope, you know, the hope that I might get better, that tomorrow might be better, or that this thing I eat right now will sit okay, you know, like those kinds of, that kind of hope is sometimes really needed. But then also I think a really important antidote can be acceptance, like just being able to be where I am even when it's really painful, and try to find anything that might give me some relief in that moment, like, you know, watching The Voice or
whatever you need,
whatever it might be in that moment that just like relieves it even a little bit.
Yeah.
And also company or connection, which can be really hard because of other people's fear. So this is the other part of fear that I wanted to talk about, because it's really hard to deal with other people's fear. Mm-hmm. And other people are really uncomfortable with the idea of illness or pain that doesn't have necessarily an end date or an answer.
Yeah, it's not finite. You can't like really grasp it.
Yeah. And I think part of that is like not wanting to see me suffer. Like mm-hmm. somebody, just kind of a friend who's really worried and is just sort of like, I want you to be better.
Right.
But then I think it's also everybody's afraid of their own health failing.
it is a reflection of our own feelings of ourself, I think, yeah. a lot of the time. I want to say, to your point about other people's fear, because I can speak to that, I guess. Knowing how you've been feeling, I've been thinking to myself, how can I not add stress to you? How can I be, like, almost fade into the background and not be as demanding? Right. I don't know how helpful that is, though, because I think I make the assumption that me being the friend that I've always been when you are in this state, when you are feeling the way that you're feeling, is overwhelming for you or is too much or you need less of... I don't know why I would rationalize it like that.
That's funny.
Because it sounds, though, as though it's... You want friends to be just as friendly as they've always been.
Yeah.
Obviously, which makes perfect sense that you're saying this to me. But I think somewhere in my brain, I was thinking to myself, you know, Lala is going through it. She doesn't need me to be, like, texting her incessantly. She doesn't need, like, the pressure of this, that, and the other thing. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think that as people who don't have chronic health issues, we make a lot of assumptions about what people, our friends, our family members are actually going through without asking them. How can I actually show up for you? What do you need from me?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, asking can be so helpful. And then it can still be hard. You know, I have had some friends like 10 times be like, can I bring you food? And I keep being like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And it took a long time for me to be like, can you bring me food? Like,
right.
You know, so
yeah.
It can be really hard. But I think asking is so nice. Because then you are able to let the person know that you're there.
Right.
But also provide the kind of support that is wanted and not the kind of support that isn't wanted.
Right.
Like, I'm really, really grateful that you mentioned acupuncture when you did. Because that was right in the middle of the crisis. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll try that. And that helped to bring me out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the sort of stereotypes of what a lot of people don't find helpful is, have you tried acupuncture? Because... when people have chronic illnesses or other kinds of illnesses, a lot of times people are like, you should do this. Have you done yoga?
It's prescriptive.
Yeah. Have you tried this herb? Have you done this? And a lot of times it's like, I don't actually need a health coach. I just need, right? I need
other
a friend.
Other things, not that. Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's times where I do want suggestions. So that's why asking can be so...
Right.
Helpful.
Yeah.
And so interesting you're talking about this fear of not wanting to, like, impose yourself as a friend. I had no idea that
basically
you felt that way.
Well, I guess it's because, well, you're also an introvert.
I am.
You're also an introvert, and I don't, and you're very, you very much know what you need, and you very much know the person that you are. So, and so I guess for me, and I don't know, I just kind of, I made an assumption basically that you needed to be, like, internal and not really out in these streets. And you didn't need me to be, I don't know, putting pressure on you. And I also was aware of the fact that a lot of what we do together is the podcast.
Yeah.
And because we can't do the podcast, I don't want you to feel as though, I don't want you to feel bad about that.
Yeah, and that I really, really appreciated, that you didn't at all make me feel bad about that or put any pressure on. And if there was something that still needed to be done, like this person emailed and wondered about this, you were, like, really wonderful about just doing it yourself or, like, offering to do it or checking in with me, you know, just I really appreciated that so much.
Good. Well, I mean, I felt like that was the least that I could do at that
yeah.
point. And I don't know. Anyways, this is a learning lesson. We're learning in public, motherfuckers. We really are learning in public because I guess looking and reflecting on how I feel I could have shown up for you in better ways, like, I would have been at your house so much more often. I guess I just thought that because I know how difficult it is for you to, you know, just be out and about.
Mm-hmm.
That being home means you just want to, like, rest and take care of yourself. But it sounds like I made an assumption. So anyways, I'm sorry about that because I...
No, yeah. And there were times where I wasn't well enough to be around people for sure. But... And I never felt like you were MIA.
Listen, this is not about... This is
like
truly
that.
Not about me, but I think this is more just about, like, as people who... love people and
yes.
care for people who are going through shit like chronic illness.
Yeah.
That we really do need to keep showing up for people when they have chronic illness flare up.
Totally, because it can be so isolating when you're just not able to do things that a lot of other people are able to do. Mm-hmm. So whether it's having to be at home in bed for long stretches of time or things like, you know, because of my health, that's why I gave up drinking alcohol.
Prior to this.
Yeah. And I can rarely go out to parties or clubs or those kinds of spaces. And that's also because of my health. And it's a big loss, and it can be very, very isolating socially. Mm-hmm. So that's really hard. And then there is also then the emotional isolation when people aren't able to hold space for, this is just really hard and there isn't an answer for it. Or like, I might die from this kind of thing, you know, which seems really extreme. But especially, again, when I was getting worse and nothing was helping, I felt a lot more connected to that, to the reality that not everybody gets better and not everybody gets an answer that is comforting.
Right.
You know, sometimes you get the bad
prognosis
and diagnosis. Yeah. Like, my stepdad just died of cancer at Christmas. You know, it's like people die.
Yeah.
And so I think it can be really emotionally isolating when everybody's so caught up in their own fear of mortality that it's like this phobia of, don't talk about that.
Right.
We also all lose out because of that. Because a few years ago, I had a really bad flare-up of my PTSD, and that was the, like, extreme panic that I would get. And So I just felt like I was about to die all the time. And then the only thing that I found comforting at that time, I read the Tibetan book of Living and Dying, and they were talking about how Western culture is so phobic of death, but that death shapes life. And that by being so phobic of it, we miss out on the chance to live the way that we would want to live if we actually were acquainted with the reality that
we're going to die at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fair point. When I'm not cognizant or aware of the fact that life is temporary, I end up just becoming like a cog in the machine.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of going through the motions, and I'm not really doing things that satisfy me or align with my, like, higher values, higher interests, higher calling, all those things that you really want to see through in your living days.
Totally.
Yeah.
And like, how many times might I have been spending hours editing out filler words when I could have been calling my sister or something like that?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Where it's like,
how are you using your time?
Yeah. And it's, I care about the podcast, but then it's,
but not
like
that, you know?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it makes you think about that idea of work doesn't keep you warm at night. Like, in some ways it does. Work is outside of the capitalist system. The things we're here to do in the world can be sources of huge joy. But again, if we actually understand that our health is fleeting and we will die, we might make different choices. And I think we're cheating ourselves out of that, as well as really letting down the people among us who are sick and who are dying,
mm-hmm,
when we're so phobic of it.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community, and we cannot do this without you.
I want to mix it up a little bit too, though, because there's a lot of hard things to talk about, but I also want to talk about some of the gifts, you know, of living with chronic health conditions. And one of them, and I'm kind of alluding to it here already, is spiritual growth for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because how do you sustain yourself?
What's a silver lining? What are the things you can look towards?
Yeah. How do you sustain yourself when there's so much fear and there's so much pain and there's so much uncertainty? And for me, spirituality is the thing that gives meaning not to just to joy, but also to pain, and not just to life, but also to death.
Right.
So when things are going well for me, it's been easy to forget sometimes about spiritual practices. Like, I've always had moments of, you know, gratitude and alignment and awe when things are going really well.
Yeah.
But in the last year, when my health felt like it was the best it's ever been in my life, but I guess in reality, maybe I was pushing myself too hard and not, like, listening to my need for rest. And I got away from a lot of my daily spiritual practices because I felt like I didn't have time for them. I was just so busy.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually having to listen to my body's insistence on slowing down or even stopping, it can be an invitation for so much more stillness and presence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know you're talking about some of the gifts. I'm curious whether or not you felt any, I don't think the word is guilt, but blaming yourself or thinking like, what if I did this one thing and then this set this off? Has that ever been something that, you know, does that resonate with you at all? Do you do that at all? Where you blame yourself for the things you're experiencing, even though there's no direct correlation between some action you took 2 months ago and how you're feeling right now?
Or maybe there is and you don't know. Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely that. And I think earlier on, I was really, anytime anybody kind of mentioned, oh, you've been pushing yourself really hard, it made me really angry because I was like, I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
Which is true. I mean, like the last year before this happened, I felt like all my dreams were coming true. Mm-hmm. And I felt better in my body than I'd ever felt. And so then the suggestion of, oh, maybe that's why, I was like, fuck that.
Yeah, like, I want to have it all. I want to have the things that make me happy. How dare you,
exactly,
you know, shit on my good time.
Exactly. But then over time, I've, like, been able to let that in a bit. And I think blame comes in a little bit, but I think where I've held more blame for myself is maybe day to day, where, like, if I eat something and then I feel really sick after, I'm, like, so angry at myself for fucking that up, even though I obviously didn't know it was going to make me feel so sick. But it's like, oh, I should have known that. I should have known I couldn't have gotten away with that.
Yeah.
Like, I had like, a little bit of sushi one day. I was like, I'm just going to have, like, not my normal amount, but I'll have a little bit, and then I'll have, like, something else that's, like, easier for my body. And then I felt so sick after, and I felt just, like, so down on myself because I was like, this is your fault.
How do you be more kind to yourself when you're in those moments? Or how do you bring yourself back to this place of appreciating the opportunity for stillness? Because I'm assuming this is not, you know, a static point. It's a linear, it's a more, I don't even know what I'm saying. My hands are moving a lot. But basically, I'm thinking you're not, like, in one state of mind for forever. So what is that? Going from feeling mad at yourself or upset with yourself for eating the thing, or you make a choice, quote unquote, and then you suffer the repercussions, to a place of, I have the opportunity to sit here and focus on things that I actually want, or I get to use my time in ways that bring me, like, joy.
It helps being a therapist because I have said to clients so many times how expensive guilt is as an emotion, like how much energy it takes up, you know, to be guilty, and how, you know, you're trying your best, and it's so important to be compassionate to yourself and not beat yourself up if you make a mistake, because, you know, you're doing the best that you can.
You really are. And you really are doing the best that you can.
And where it comes back, I think, to spirituality for me is, it's those moments of mindful self-compassion, of being able to, like, put my hand on my heart and say, this is really hard, which is, for me, something I've learned as a spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the having compassion for yourself and your suffering sounds like the opposite of spiritual bypassing type shit, where you're just like, okay, well, you know, it's going to be fine. Just pray about it. And it's like, no, I want to sit with it.
Exactly. Like, I spent more time crying, you know, than the 2 weeks that were the worst. I cried more than in the, like, 2 years preceding that, you know. But it was really important to just be able to be in pain. And I don't know, it's complicated though, because at the worst of it, it was very hard to have presence and stillness, because being in my body I was in so much pain and suffering that I really, really felt like I needed to distract myself, because that was the only way it was tolerable to exist, you know,
right,
in those moments.
Yeah.
So distraction is really important too sometimes. And it's been, now that I'm getting a little bit more of my health back, that I've been able to practice more spirituality, and it's a good reminder to myself to be practicing, to be meditating when I can, and be engaged with learning spiritually when I can, because I really need that when I'm at my worst, and it'll be more accessible to me if I've been building that muscle.
Yeah, that's very fair.
So it's all very complicated, but I know that spirituality is the thing that can give meaning to even my worst moments. And slowness is something that was just forced on me, but I'm more and more able to integrate it more. And so you can think too about, I was just listening to a podcast where people were talking about disability. I can't remember who the person was, but they were talking about hiking. And if you're, you know, able-bodied and in great shape and you're able to hike, and that's like a particular experience in nature. But if you're not able to do that and you're just able to go and sit on the grass, you're able to have a deeper relationship with the ground in a way that if you were walking at a fast pace, you're experiencing nature in a certain way, but you're not sitting in deep relationship with what's around you in the same way.
Yeah. When you're talking about finding meaning in, let's say, the grass, is that sounds very different than when people say it all happens for a reason. Can you share what the difference, or is that different?
I think one of the differences is when it's imposed on you,
as opposed to when you get to define it for yourself.
So if in a moment where I'm feeling a lot of grief over the things that I've lost and I'm angry about it, if someone says to me, well, it happens for a reason, it's like, fuck you.
100%.
I'm allowed to be angry and I'm allowed to not want this.
Yeah.
But for me personally, my overarching beliefs are that, well, I like to think of the idea that sometimes people talk about the spiritual idea that you choose the soul, you choose how you're going to incarnate, essentially.
Oh, wow.
And, like, who you're going to be in the world and what you're going to do.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that I necessarily believe that, but I find it a useful thought exercise at times when I'm really suffering to think, why would I choose this? Because that, to me, is a way to start to figure out what can I learn from this, or how do I want to grow from this?
Right.
And so I think that's what's happening for me now, for example, is I'm like, okay, I'm being brought back to my spirituality. I'm being forced to balance my life in a different way and think about what my priorities are. And did this happen so that I would come to that? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lot easier for me to get through this if I feel like I'm growing from it in a way that is useful to me, or that gives me something that I didn't have before.
I feel like when you're saying this, it also gives you some autonomy and, like, decision making, because largely your illness is imposed on you by your body doing whatever your body's doing, or your environment, or things that you don't have the control over. And it sounds as though for you in the past few months, having autonomy to be able to define what this means to you and how you're going to use it and how it's going to serve you is super helpful, because it sounds like it's been very disempowering to not be able to do the things you normally do, or have the control that you normally have over your schedule, or pushing your body in ways that you found, you know, really liberating and exciting that you can't do anymore. And so it's like, where do you find that? Sounds like it's through mindfulness.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, it is. That's a big part of it. And now it's through rebuilding in a way that I can. It's like I've experienced a lot of loss, and I don't know if those losses are permanent or not. But instead of focusing on that, though there will still be moments where I focus on it and I'm sad or angry or whatever it might be, I think now I'm feeling like I'm at a moment where I'm getting ready to rebuild, and okay, what could a new routine look like? I am learning to value slowness as much as, I don't know, it's still hard. I loved the pace that I was at before.
Right.
If my health is never going to allow me, maybe never going to allow me to have that pace, that feels really sad, but I feel like I can adjust to something new, and also make space for whatever grief I might have about that or anger that I might have about that.
And you have been adjusting. Totally. And you've been adjusting.
Yeah.
It's like you've proven it to yourself that you can pivot accordingly.
Yeah.
So I guess, does that make you feel better equipped for tomorrow's? Like, when you know, okay, you know, it's been really fucking shitty. I've had a really hard go. I've been feeling awful and terrible. Is there any sense of, I don't know if the word is, like, pride in yourself? Because you're handling shit in a way that I think a lot of people, and a lot of folks have to handle shit in ways that, for a lot of us who don't suffer from debilitating pain or chronic illness, we'll never grasp, we'll never understand it. You're still working, you know, you're still doing, we're in this room, it sounds as though you're feeling better, but you're not fully better, right?
No, not at all.
So you've made a new normal for, like, you had to accept this new normal.
Yeah, yeah, and it's different day to day, but it does make me in some ways feel more prepared, because again, it reminds me of the reality that everything is temporary. You know,
so, and you're finding that you're learning that lesson sooner than a lot of folks learn it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm sure I'll have to learn that over and over and over again. And it's the kind of thing you have to keep learning. But it feels very important, because it feels like a deeper truth than I can exceed the limitations that I had put on myself. I never thought I'd be able to do this thing, and now I've done it. And that's amazing, and it's a wonderful thing, but loss is a more enduring part of life.
Totally.
So.
You say that with a smile on your face. I wonder how much, I guess I'm curious about how you find where you've had to carve out room for joy, or how you would practice joy.
It's like any moment I could find it. So there was like weeks where like painting my nails was like
the thing,
the only, like, that was like the big thing,
right?
Was like, oh, this is like a different color than I've ever worn before. But the last thing, and I think the most important thing I wanted to talk about that I've been learning from illness, is around care. And how important it is for me to care for myself, to accept care from others, and when I'm able to give care to others. It's cliche, but I think we are needing better, deeper, more intentional, meaningful care practices. And it's really hard because of all of the toxic, oppressive ideologies that we internalize. So, like, the idea of self-sufficiency, that we shouldn't depend on other people for support. And, of course, everyone's dependent, right? But some people are privileged enough that they're far removed from all of the people who make their lives possible. And so they don't have to specifically ask for help, because the world was built with their needs in mind. So without having to ask for help, they can tell themselves that, you know, they don't actually need help, even though their help is just built into the world. And I think it's really toxic to believe that there's like a some kind of like inherent value or some kind of pride in not having to ask for help. Because I think it really isolates us from each other, and I think it harms the people who the world wasn't made for, right? Who have to ask for help, because the world wasn't designed for us.
Right, because then it pits those people, or paints those people to be, have far more needs than, you know, the people who aren't asking for help.
Yeah.
And it's like, everyone needs help. Everyone needs that support. But
yeah.
All those people are able to verbalize it because they literally have none.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's, of course, the myth of productivity, which is the idea that we earn our keep on earth by being productive. And if we're not productive, then we don't deserve anything. Like, we don't deserve care and support. And maybe most importantly, since we live under capitalism, that we don't deserve money. And without money, we can't access anything we need to take care of ourselves, right? Like healthy food, medications, or mobility aids, or healthcare in a lot of cases. And like, the only reason that I'm getting better, or that I'm better now than I was a few weeks ago, is because of my access to money. I've had access to money to pay for Chinese medicine practitioners. I've been able to spend more money on food. I've been able to work less, things like that. So that access to money is everything.
Absolutely.
And so this myth of productivity, that we have to be productive and that's what life is about, that is how we have so many people who are needlessly suffering and dying because we're not able to actually care for each other or value each other in the way that we should if we weren't so brainwashed by capitalism. Mm. So part of the perfectionism I'm having to let go of is feeling like, you know, I wish that I'd had the time and energy to do more research and weave in, you know, the disability justice movement more. But in the spirit of interdependence, what I'm going to do instead is use our Women of Color of the Week segment to direct everybody to an amazing place to get a lot of that information. So it's this book, Care Work, and our Woman of Color of the Week is Leah Lakshmi Pyapsna Samarasena. And the book Care Work, Dreaming Disability Justice, it's the most beautiful book that gives us a chance to witness this amazing woman of color in her experiences and also understand a lot of the politics of the issues and dream what it could look like to not have access be sort of an add-on afterthought to our movements, but have it actually be at the very heart of our movements.
Like accessibility.
Yeah, and including disabled folks. And again, not just including, but centering and
having them at the helm.
Having movements that don't leave people behind. Mm-hmm. Doing the work and building the networks that it takes in order to care for each other under the conditions that we live in that are so hostile to, especially poor Black and brown disabled folks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I just want to read where she talks about what the book is. So she says, one quality of disability justice culture is that it's simultaneously beautiful and practical. Poetry and dance are as valuable as a blog post about access hacks because they're equally important and interdependent. This book is an example of both, and the making of disability justice lives in the realm of thinking and talking and knowledge making in art and sky. So I feel like that gives you just a little bit of a feeling for how important this love work is. And yeah, I just really want everybody to read this book because it's such a gift to all of us, those of us who are disabled and those of us who are not. So thank you to Leah.